Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is The Police as Public Servants. Our guest today is Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank. Chief Burbank has been with the Salt Lake City Police Department since 1991. Appointed to the position of Chief of Police in March of 2006, he became the 45th Chief of the department. Chief Burbank has been an outspoken opponent to the cross-deputization of police officers as immigration enforcement agents. He has participated in several national conferences regarding the issue, including the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division's 2009 Title VI conference. In May of 2010, Chief Burbank and nine other police chiefs met with Attorney General Eric Holder regarding Arizona immigration laws. During the last 2 years, he has addressed the House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary regarding racial profiling and civil rights issues. Chief Burbank was chosen by the Salt Lake Tribune as Utahn of the Year in 2011. The state's largest newspaper cited his handling of several high-profile protest incidents and stated, quote, "Burbank's stature as a community leader, including a willingness to endure threats and criticism over his position on immigration enforcement, is noteworthy at the time of ebbing confidence in those elected to govern." Chief Burbank has a Bachelor's of Science degree in Sociology from the University of Utah and is a graduate of the FBI's National Executive Institute, Class XXX, and serves on the Board of Directors for the NEI Associates. Chief Burbank also serves as the first vice president of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, an assembly of 69 largest policing agencies in the United States and Canada. He served as the chair of the Valley Police Alliance during its inception and is proud to sit on the Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training Council. Please join me in welcoming Chief Chris Burbank.
Thank you very much. The introduction takes longer than the entire time I have, and I apologize for that. I enjoy the opportunity to come and speak because I think that when we talk about police officers as servants, right, that's exactly what we are here to be, and we've often forgotten that throughout our history. Because if you look back through history, police officers have been a very effective arm of oppression, right? And so when biased laws, inappropriate laws have been put into place, who better than the local law enforcement to go out and enforce these? Because we stand as a ready force, willing, right, and able, because of our mandate, to go out and interact with the public. And so if we send people out, and this really is a police administration problem or quandary, if you send people out with certain missions, you potentially interject bias. And so one of those that was mentioned is immigration enforcement. And the reason that I'm so opposed to immigration enforcement by local law enforcement is because, consider Salt Lake City. Right? The census came out and about 25% of our population is Latino. If you look at the school census, about 33% of our population is Latino. In some of our high schools in Salt Lake City, 85-90% of the school population is minority. Why would we want to alienate that many people and not have them interact with the police department? And let me give you an example, because it's always important, I think, to look at what's going on realistically, right? What's happening now. And so if you consider our homeless population, and where is the place to buy drugs in Salt Lake City? Pioneer Park, thank you very much. Absolutely. And why is Pioneer Park such a great place to buy drugs, or to sell drugs if you happen to be on the other side of this? It's nice and shady, it's very pretty, I don't know. Absolutely, right? So now, narcotics is really a business, right? If you're in the business of selling narcotics, you want to sell lots of drugs, right? And so you sell them to the people who are using. So in the case of the... Well, it is. It is. And you sell them to the population of people who are going to use them. The other thing is, we in society have always said that the homeless are loud and down in that area because that's where all the service providers are. And until just recently, when they started to build malls and housing down there, there was nothing but train tracks and the homeless services. And so we drove by and we said, okay, we're fine. We don't mind what goes on down here because that's the homeless and it doesn't impact us. So if you take that same activity and put it up here on the University of Utah campus or in the neighborhood on the East Bench, I'm going to get lots of calls that say, hey, there's somebody standing on the street corner selling drugs. But down there, we allow that to take place. Now, you have a population of people who, one, have some addiction problems, certainly in our homeless population, but two, right, are not often fond of the police or have a great deal of trust because police are always called when they're intoxication issues, trespassing issues, unwanted people panhandling downtown. We get all kinds of phone calls on this. So the police are always having negative interactions with many of our homeless people that live in Salt Lake City. So they don't want to have an interaction. They don't want to have the trust and confidence of the police department. And so what happens is as a dope dealer, I can force you as a homeless person to hold my drugs for me. And if you take any, I'm going to take you out back and beat you up. Right? And that way, if the police stop me, I only lose what little bit of product I have, not the whole stash. And you're going to hold my money, so I never lose all of it at once. And, oh, I'll give you a little taste because I know you're addicted. You all just threaten. And nobody reports that to the police because of this mistrust, right? The lack of confidence that we're going to do something, that we're actually going to be able to protect these people. So now take the same thing when you look at our immigrant population. And in fact, we conducted a study in Salt Lake City that we brought in a bunch of researchers from across the country from different universities to look at, would people be more likely to or less likely to report crime to the police or participate with the police if we were acting as immigration enforcement agents? And what we found is, and not surprisingly, those people who are undocumented would certainly be less likely to contact the police and let us know about a crime that's occurring. And we see that time and time again. Right? People are the victims of domestic violence and do not want to contact the police, right? For fear because of their status, or even in some cases the status of the perpetrator. But because they're the breadwinner, they're the father of their children, and some of those other things, they don't bother calling the police for fear of deportation. In fact, there was a very large case that happened back east where an individual was severely beaten in the hallway of an apartment complex. And there was blood on the floor, and he was gone. Right? And the only way that anyone found out about it is someone noticed the blood, so they went and checked the security camera. And sure enough, this individual had been beaten severely. So they followed up. The police did and contacted this person and found out that, in fact, his status, he was a legal resident of the United States. But because he had relatives that were living with him that were not and did not want to bring their status into question with the police department. Right? He nearly died from his injuries. We had some workers here locally. Individual fell on a construction site. And because of his status, didn't want to take him directly to the hospital. And drove him around for a long time and almost lost his life for fear that this would cause a deportation action to take place. That is not what police are about or should be about. Right? We should be servants. We should be available to every member of society, regardless of what your status may be, regardless of what your belief system may be, and in fact, regardless of whether or not you are committing criminal acts. Because everybody should be treated equally and fairly. And even those people, right? We have lots of laws on the books that say, this is how you treat people who are involved in criminal activity. And there's rights that kick in. And the Constitution is set up. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say you have to be a resident, you have to be a certain race, you have to be, criminal, non-criminal. The rights protected by the Constitution are there for everybody. And that is really our number one goal, is to ensure that every single person enjoys those freedoms. And when we are viewed otherwise, which has happened again and again throughout history, well, then public trust erodes. And my opinion, certainly is, when we don't have the trust and participation of the community, that's when crime escalates. And that's exactly what you see in the example of our homeless population, or I believe you certainly see in the case of our immigrant population. When people are unwilling to cooperate with us, and it's a mistake that we've made in this country and how we've dealt with terrorism. Because I believe that we have alienated some of the very people, Muslim Americans, who are our best source of information about someone within their community who might be intent on committing a crime against the United States. But because we take a blanket approach, because we like to have enemies, right, it becomes very easy to point to somebody and say, this is the problem and this is how we can deal with it. And so, how many of you remember the Trolley Square incident that we had here? Right? An 18-year-old Bosnian refugee went into Trolley Square and ended up killing five people before my officers took his life. And there was huge outcry. I mean, it had to be video games. It had to be the fact that he was a Muslim. It had to be the fact that he was Bosnian. And I mean, on and on and on as to what was the cause of this. And there was really no cause other than a young man who decided that this was the right outlet for his anger and energy. But there was not, you know, he was not a radical. He certainly was not on the web posting information. He didn't play violent video games. There was nothing that would lead to this. But what happens when that occurs is society now realizes that, well, wait a minute, that was Trolley Square. We shop there. We, you know, that's a regular kind of thing. That happened to people who are not kind of on the outside. Right? That actually came into us. And the unfortunate thing about all the shootings that have taken place, all these mass shootings that have taken place, and I don't want to minimize them because they are horrible, tragic events that, you know, people have lost their lives, and I certainly, you know, for the victims of those in society, it's a terrible cost. But in this country, every single day, more people die than in any one of these shootings from gun violence and violence. The city of Chicago had 550-something homicides last year alone. That's one city. Right? Averaging over one a day. That's outrageous. But why do we not stand up and say, hey, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. We need to do something about this. Because oftentimes it becomes very easy to view and say, hey, that happens to a segment of society that doesn't impact us. But when you see these shootings, when someone walks into a school in middle-class America, then all of a sudden we have tremendous outcry that we need to do something. We just need to be careful about the decisions that we make and how it goes back again on police administration and the public. Because in the case of Trolley Square, I was absolutely confident, and still am to this day, had I stood up and said, I'm going to round up every Bosnian in Salt Lake City and interrogate them to find out if they're involved in this criminal activity, the majority of the population would have cheered and said, yes, that's a good thing to do, Chief. Way to go. Because when we don't have that criminal, right, when we don't have the problem to point to, it could happen to any of us. But when we can say, okay, this is what the bad person looks like, this is what their behavior's like, well, now I can stand apart from that and say, well, I don't engage in that activity, right? I'm not going to associate with those types of people. In fact, I'm going to be strong on laws that impact those type of people. But what we don't really get to is that underlying root cause of why did they do this? Right? Why did they engage in this behavior? Which is not because of the color of their skin. And it's very naive to think it's because of their religious belief. Although, I mean, things like that certainly have played impact on that. But there's other things that have impact and effect on that. And that's really where we need to focus. And if you think about it, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, had a state senator stood up and said, I believe that all blacks are more criminal and so thus we should jail them, they would have been thrown out of office. But we have actually had, United States representatives, local representatives, stand up and say, Hispanic people that commit more crimes, right? These undocumented, these illegal people commit more crimes, and thus we need to be hard on them, and they got applause. In fact, it moved the country in a direction that's very scary. Because my notion of freedom for myself and for my family and why I enjoy the United States, and I've been very fortunate to do a lot of travel outside this country and to interact with a lot of different cultures. But one of the things that I enjoy most is the fact that if I want to take my family to Disneyland, I don't need to carry a passport. In fact, if I'm not going to operate a motor vehicle, I don't even need to take a driver's license. I don't have to worry that if I travel through, well, let's see, I'd start in Utah, I'd go through Arizona, hit Nevada, and then California, that I don't have to worry about being checked at the border of all those states as to whether or not I'm okay to travel through there. And so it's very scary when you have a population of people who say, oh, I'm okay if everyone has to be checked and carry identification. Well, I'm absolutely not. I'm not okay with that. That's not how this country is founded. And that, I don't think, is the intent of the people who framed the Constitution. And so it's very, again, a very scary thing, because I can, simply by saying, we're going to go out and enforce, let's say, insurance. Right? I want my officers. Lack of driver or lack of automobile insurance is a great problem in the city of Salt Lake. I want you to go out and be very hard on this. Track down all those people that you can identify that don't have insurance. Who are my officers going to interact with? Absolutely. Right? It becomes a socioeconomic issue. But consequently, then, who are the poor in our city and our country? Absolutely. Those people that we call minorities. Right? People of color. So now I'm going to have a huge number of stops. Well, are those officers biased in how they're doing enforcement? Am I necessarily biased? No, I'm just looking at the problem that, because, boy, we've got a lot of crashes taking place and people don't have insurance, so we need to do something about that. But it absolutely does interject bias. And so it's something that we need to constantly be aware of. And when I say we, it's not just about policing, right? Because policing is one part of that. But it's also about the laws that go into place that drive what the police do, that we need to make sure that our laws don't interject bias. And so it's a tremendous responsibility. And I am a firm believer, right, as you look in the last, 40 years of criminal activity, right, crime in the United States, violence in the United States peaked in the mid-90s and was significant. And you look at some of the events that led up to that, right? There were a lot of lack of public trust situations that took place. And what we've seen in even very difficult economic times, last year in this country, there were 44,000 police officer vacancies, more than the year before. So that was 44,000 police officers who were working the year before, were not working the next year in this country, mostly because of economic crisis and budgets. Well, crime continued to decline. We have fewer police officers now than we did in the 90s, but crime continues to go down. Well, isn't it, if you had more police officers, wouldn't crime be less? And I will always say that while we influence it, right, absolutely we have some impact on it, we are not the ones that drive the crime rate. Because there will never be enough police officers in this country to stand on every single corner and stop crime from occurring. In fact, if you put one on every single corner, it just occurs in the middle of the block. Right? There's a certain level of activity. And until we in society say we're not going to tolerate that, right, it will continue to go on. But again, we have enough good people that live here that if they're willing to participate, if they have the trust and confidence that the criminals will actually be treated fairly, right? That the police won't be heavy-handed, they're going to call and engage and say, hey, guess what? There's a problem going on and we need you to be here. If you have Muslim Americans who do not feel that they're being profiled in the airport, on the streets, as they travel, who who are not engaged in criminal activity, who are citizens of the country, who are everything other than they believe a certain way. But if they have the trust and confidence in the system and they have, find somebody or encounter somebody that they believe might actually be a threat, they are going to be more inclined to say, hey, this is what I know. Right? The undocumented lady who is the victim of domestic violence, or whose children might be abused, is going to be more inclined to participate with the police department and get the help that she needs. Right? It's not about, and we should always remember, it's not about putting someone in jail all the time. Because we've been incarcerating people in this country at a higher rate than any other nation in the world. And it hasn't solved our criminal activity. In fact, we have more problems, especially violent crime and gun crime, than any other nation in the world. But yet we incarcerate more people. We put more bad guys in jail. Why? You would think we'd be the lowest. Because we put all the bad people in jail. But it's not the case. Because we've been very ineffective at dealing with what is the cause of this problem. So again, it's not necessarily about putting it, but it's about taking that person or that lady and her children out of the situation or giving her the help she needs to, in order to deal with that situation. And then even the perpetrator of that crime, making sure that he has the understanding that this is not how you are involved in a marriage or a relationship. But that doesn't necessarily occur. Okay. I've talked, and as you can see, I can talk for a long time. I'd much rather answer your questions, and they can go anywhere, right? I'm happy to talk about anything, so please.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm a senior in political science. I'm not super educated about the issue, but I was wondering if you'd talk for a minute just about kind of citizen review boards and if you think that's a good way to increase public trust between the public and the police department?
Good question. I love civilian review boards. Give you a little history lesson, right? When you talk the 70s, Dragnet, I'm dating myself, Adam 12, these shows that are reruns for most of you, right? Police cars came along, really fast police cars that were cool. Right, lights and sirens, and you had radios in the cars, and we could communicate and all these other things. And we didn't like corruption occurring in our cities, right? Because if you allow the police to interact with the public one-on-one, well, then there's bribes and there's all these other things. So what we're going to do is we're going to put you in fast cars. If you have a problem, we will respond really quickly, and we don't care about you. What we care about is just the facts, ma'am, right? And we'll give you a report, and then we'll be on our way to the next one. Right? And so we didn't allow for public corruption or corruption of the police. And that kind of became the theme in how we did business. And we told the public, we're the police, we know best. You stand aside and we'll tell you what we want to when we want to. And the public accepted that. Well, we had some things that really eroded public trust and confidence in the police, Rodney King being one of them. As that developed, what you saw is the public say, hey, wait a minute, we don't like how this is going out. We want to have more input. We want to have more participation. We want to tell you. Well, that's hard on some old-time police chiefs especially. Who knows better than the police, right, what our business is? How can you tell me how to do my business? And so for a while it was viewed very negatively. But what you saw is you started to see more public input or demand for input that created civilian review boards. I like public input. In fact, I think it is the direction we need to go. In fact, I think it's the reason that we've seen crime decline in light of economic problems and crisis. Because what happens when you invite the public in, this goes back to what I said about crime, about everything that goes on, right? It's not just the police issue. It's not just the 450 police officers I have working for me. It's the entire 182,000 people that live in Salt Lake and the 300,000 that come into Salt Lake every single day to work and play, right? It now becomes your responsibility to participate with me, right? You are now responsible for crime, because we're very naive to say, boy, we had a homicide on the, downtown. Well, is that my problem, right? Is that my fault? Could have I prevented that? And I would say in a lot of cases, especially homicide, right, these are not easily prevented. Right, it's not. Now, maybe had I had a police officer standing there at that very moment, maybe. But right, you play the odds, where are you gonna, and then it just becomes this arms race, I guess, for lack of a better term, of, well, we just need more police officers to solve the problem. No, what we need is more public input and participation. And so by allowing the public and saying, yeah, come in and tell me what you think. Right? Interact with the police department. Tell me what you think about how my officers behave, right? What type of crimes that we enforce and think are important, how we deal with people after we arrest them. Well, now the public has responsibility to participate with us. And so it's not just a matter of, boy, we have crime, so it's the police department's fault. So public input is very important, and civilian review boards are important to that. The civilian review board was hard. It's been in place in Salt Lake City, actually predating me as the police chief. So for about, well, there was a model of it early on in the late 90s that came around in Salt Lake City. It wasn't very effective until the last 8 or 9 years. But it's something that, as far as my officers, they don't notice it. Right? The Civilian Review Board in Salt Lake City's case has the ability, every single complaint that comes into the police department, whether external or whether generated from inside. And interestingly enough, about 60% of the complaints in the police department are generated by the police department. So that's other officers or my sergeant saying, hey, somebody did something that I don't believe is right. And they have the ability as a Civilian Review Board to look at every single one of those and say, yes, we want to participate, and they get to come and ask questions of the officer, sit in on all the interviews, and then they issue a report to me that says this is what we think. First off, this is what we think the officer did, and they have the ability to say this is how we think you ought to discipline them. And it's something that I take very seriously. And interestingly enough, we don't always agree. In fact, the individual who runs our Civilian Review Board always likes to say that there have been cases that the Civilian Review Board has exonerated my officers and said, we don't believe they did anything wrong or any action, and I've disciplined them. And there's been a few that they've said, we think they did wrong, and I've said, no. But I still have to stand up and be responsible for that decision and say, this is why I'm different. But so it works very well, and it's something that I advocate, and in fact, have actually gone in different parts of the country and talked to people about civilian review boards and the importance of them. What else? Please.
My name's Tyler Calder. I'm an econ student here. And I just have a question. You were talking about how a lot of our laws are ineffective at finding the root cause. And I was just wondering, how effective do you think our drug laws are today at finding the root cause and fighting crime?
The laws, when you consider drugs and narcotics, are good in certain respects, right? I am not an advocate for legalization. And because what is the most regulated substance that you can think of in the United States today?
Alcohol.
Alcohol in this state, maybe. But there's one even more than that. Prescription medication. Right? Look at the process in order for a drug company to get a drug to market. I mean, it's extensive. And then the regulation with prescribing and everything else that comes along with that. The number one abuse thing in this state, right, more than heroin, more than cocaine, is prescription medication. And in fact, that is becoming the trend across the country. Interestingly enough, some of the major drug cartels that you would traditionally say are cocaine, heroin dealers, and those types of things, are now engaged in prescription medication because the markup business is so much better. Right? You get $10 a chip for heroin on the street, you get $80 a pill on Oxy on the street. So if I'm in business, right, I want to make money, what am I going to sell? And so we've been ineffective with the most regulated substance of controlling that. So the notion that you will now say marijuana, cocaine, whatever it is now legal, right, and we're going to regulate it somehow is silly. Because there will always be an illegal market for those people who don't meet the criteria for it, or an illegal market for a substance that is just slightly different, slightly stronger. In fact, marijuana today is, I think they have 50 times stronger, more potent than what it was in the 60s. And in fact, there's marijuana, BC Bud is a big one, that the THC content is very high coming across the border, right? And so if you draw the line and say, okay, we're the state, we're now going to regulate marijuana, and here's the level of THC that we're going to allow, well, there will always be a market for something else. And in fact, in states like Colorado and Washington and California, where they've wandered down this road of medicinal marijuana and now legalization, right, what has happened in the state of Utah is our public grows on public lands. Because if you grow marijuana and the cops show up at your house and you're growing marijuana illegally, right, your house, your car, your assets are subject to seizure by the government. So if you grow marijuana down in Zion National Park, they can't seize anything. So guess who's doing it? The drug cartels. And those drugs are not going into the state of Utah. They're going into Colorado to feed all the medicinal marijuana dispensaries. So this notion that people are just kind of growing a little for their need in the backyard or wherever it may be is silly. No. You're making the drug cartels. They love that. Makes us rich. And in fact, the oppression and everything else and the violence associated with that, you go on they kill people down there. And what they do basically is they take undocumented individuals, bring them across the border and say, you will grow marijuana here, you will keep it safe, and you're going to live on this case of beans for the next 4 months until you harvest the crop. Right? And if you do anything wrong, they kill you and bury you in the desert out there. But guess what? This is what you're doing. And you have the exploitation that takes place, you have the violence that takes place, and you have the money going back to the drug cartels. So, long thing about legalization, but the problem that we have with drugs, in my opinion, and our drug laws, is we focus too much on you commit a violation, you go to jail. Those people who are engaged in, now, selling is one thing, using is another thing, and possession sort of things. We need to do more diversion and get to why people are addicted to a substance. Because unfortunately, the overcrowding issues and everything else that's involved in this. So if somebody's arrested, let's say, for a possession charge, and they really have a significant habit, they spend 2 days in jail, they're back out on the street, they're using again, and we never solve the problem. But when you see things like drug court, where as opposed to just being sentenced to jail, they say, okay, we won't send you to jail if you agree to come in on a regular basis and take your analysis, if you meet with a counselor and these other things. Right? Recidivism in this country, in this state, is about 67%. When you use drug court and some of these other diversions or alternative programs, recidivism drops to about 45%. That's a significant decrease and much more effective, and that's where we need to focus. It's not just about locking people away. And one of the things that I don't like, and Gil Kerlikowski, who runs ONDCP, we're not at war. It's not a war on drugs. We're not at war with the people who live in the country. Right? That's a bad term. We need to look at how do we solve this problem, which is a significant problem. And interestingly enough, this problem is not the drug cartels. Right? It's not the dope dealers. It's the fact that there is such a high demand for this that somebody will always meet that need as long as there's a demand, because I can make lots and lots of money. And so what we need to deal with, if we actually want to do away with drug abuse and all those other things and the crime associated with it, well, then we need to deal with the addiction problem. Because if the demand dries up, the supply is going to go somewhere else because they're not making any money. Please.
My name is Carter Folger. I'm a student in political science here at the U. You seem like you have more of a level head on your shoulders than I kind of expected.
Thank you.
My question pertains to like the open letter that the Sheriff's Association sent to the legislator saying that, you know, come and get our guns, this whole nine yards. And it seems like you would not be somebody that would be kind of behind signing something like that.
You are right.
would you respond to that? Or what do you think about the Sheriff's Association and what they kind of went?
Okay, I will absolutely respond to that. I was extremely fortunate. In fact, it's been, a month and a half ago? I got invited to the White House to sit down with the president and talk about violence and guns. And so I spent an hour and a half with the president and said, this is what my opinion is. As was stated, I am the vice president of the Major City Chiefs. And we actually, 10 years ago, drafted a white paper that we, as far as limiting magazine capacity, restricting firearms and those types of things, that this should not take place, right? That we ought to, well, it should take place, right, that we ought to do these laws and regulations that we cannot have the violence occurring in America. And so I do not believe, because no matter what side of the issue you're on, I don't care if you are pro-gun or you hate them, right? The problem that we have in this country is we have individuals who have access to firearms that are intent on doing violence and killing people, right? That is a simple, they have access and they shouldn't have it. And why do they have access? Because we have a lot of guns available for a whole bunch of different reasons. We have regulated firearms in this country for many, many years. In fact, in order to get what's termed a Class 3 firearm, which is an automatic weapon, a suppressed weapon, so a silencer, right? A shortened barrel length, shortened stock, or anything like that, you need to go through a process with the ATF, and that form actually comes to the police chief that I get to run a background check on the person and say, yes, this person has not committed a criminal act. I do not believe, given what we know, that they are prone to violence or going to cause problems. Interestingly enough, those are not the people that are going out and committing crimes, and they have automatic weapons because we have some responsibility and reasonableness in order to check that. So I'm not one of those guys that say, take away all the guns, right? Because I don't think that's realistic. But I'm also not the guy that says the best solution is to give everyone a gun because that's, again, not realistic. Somewhere in the middle of this debate is reasonableness. What happens is reasonableness gets lost. And so we have the ability to regulate firearms, not against the Second Amendment, right? Nowhere in the Second Amendment, in my interpretation or anything that's been interpreted by the Supreme Court of the United States, does it say you have the right to carry whatever you want to, in whatever manner you want to, right? And the silliness is, now think about this for a minute, because this just drives me insane. If I told all my officers, imagine if you are driving down the street, and you're driving a little fast. So one of my police officers pulls you over, and he walks up to the car with an AR-15 slung over his chest, right? He bends down high today, bang, 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 into your car and everything else. Are you going to feel really comfortable? And in fact, the outcry is going to be, it's a police state. How can you can't arm the police like this? It's intimidating. It's horrible. But yet we want the public to walk around like that and think it's okay? I mean, reasonableness went out the window on that one. The other thing that is really difficult is if somebody walks in the back door right now with a rifle slung on their chest, there's nothing I can do about it until he levels a gun and shoots somebody. Trolley Square, right? That young man had 1,000 rounds of ammunition, had a handgun and a shotgun, and was intent on killing people. Not only did he shoot them with the shotgun, he went up and made sure that he killed them afterwards. And there was nothing a police officer could have done or said was illegal until the point that he levels that gun and kills Jeff Walker outside on the steps. Now, how do you think Vicky, his wife, would feel walking into Trolley Square and someone walking around with a shotgun slung across their chest? We've lost sight of what's reasonable and right. And we take away the ability of our police officers to interact. I'm not even against concealed carry. Right? Because most of the time, there's some education that takes place. Right? There's a process. You get a permit. There's some checks that are done. Most of the time when I've dealt with people with concealed weapons permits, they say, hey, I'm a concealed weapons permit. This is where the gun is, everything. We have no problems or issues because we have some reasonableness and some education that takes place. But the notion that everyone's going to carry a firearm, at what point do I know or feel? Now, imagine if you're the 7-Eleven clerk and this happens. Right, this is not me making this up in my mind. 7-Eleven clerk's working. It's about 12:30 at night. Some guy gets out of his car and he's got a gun. What's that phone call like before he hits the front door of the 7-Eleven? He's already got the cops on the phone. Hey, there's a guy with a gun coming in the store. I'm sure he's going to rob me. Right? Or do we expect that person to wait because, oh, I'm sure it's a very nice person. He's not going to cause you any problems, right? Until he says, give me your money. Unreasonable, right? There needs to be some reasonableness. Sorry, I get a little carried away on this one. There needs to be some reasonableness in this debate. And that is something, again, when you look at polling that takes place in the country or in this state or in the city, the public does not want this, right? But we get this polarized The middle is where it needs to be and drive most of the issues, to talk really political. Right? But we lose sight of the middle. And so you allow the fringe to say, this is what it is, and rule and make our decisions. And we have a responsibility to stand up and say, no, wait a minute. Right? We want to weigh in on this debate. We want to participate and say, this is not reasonable and something needs to be done. So I think we're headed in the right direction as far as some of the rules and regulations that are in place. And I do not agree in the case of the sheriff's office. Interestingly enough, in that particular case, I have yet to see, and I've been privy to the president's, you know, prior to him releasing it, to bills in Congress of what they anticipate, and every single one of them has a clause in there that says, nobody is going to come take your guns away. Anything that exists already, we're not going to take it away. Right? It's how we're going to regulate from here on out, which, again, is reasonable. But people don't read the legislation. People don't take the time to understand what's going on. And so you get somebody who stands up and say that. It's just no different than someone who stands up and says, oh, yeah, I've watched TV. Right? Hispanics, they're committing all the crimes. Right? They're all drug dealers. And, in fact, I like to play a little game. We won't take time because we're running out. But I could stand up members of this class and say, okay, what does a drug dealer look like? Right? When we watch TV, that's where most people learn about police work and everything else. I'm sorry, what's your name, sir?
Kenny.
Garcia, man. Of course, he's involved in it, right? Because I've seen TV. And not only that, right? I'm sure Kenny is undocumented. I mean, this is the silliness that we start interjecting. We cannot put in place laws that, again, take away the ability of the police officer to be reasonable. Right? Because everything that the law is based on is behavior-driven. Right? So probable cause and reasonable suspicion, the two things that police officers operate in order to make a stop. Right? I see this person here. I think he's engaged in criminal activity because I see something. Right? That is reasonable. That is what gives me the right to interject and say, hey, wait a minute, you're not free to walk down the street because of your behavior. Not because he's wearing the black shirt today or the color of his skin or anything else. Right? It's because of what I can observe and say is his behavior. And whenever we start to wander outside that and go weird, and so that's what you get as far as gun laws, right? Somebody who walks into the 7-Eleven with a pistol on their is not a reasonable thing, and it causes alarm, as it should. So we need to look for some middle ground and reasonableness, please.
Hi, my name is Sam Brookham, student here at the U. I was actually going to ask pretty much the exact same question, so I'll just follow up on that. I think, as I understand, like quite a hefty amount of the mass shootings, you know, over history have occurred while people have been like on pharmaceutical drugs. Is there a big concern with that in legislature and, you know, within the police department? And do you think we ever get to that point like Australia did, where they have a buyback system? You know, people can bring in whatever guns and you get, you know, try and get some of that stuff off the street.
Are you from Australia?
No, I'm English.
Oh, okay. We have tried that, and we've actually done buybacks in Salt Lake City. They've done buybacks in different parts of the country. There's not a national buyback program, but, I mean, we have done some of those things. Yes, there are some concerns with some of those. I just attended a meeting that had a whole bunch of researchers that had looked at all the mass shootings, including Salt Lake City and some of those others that had occurred across the country. The difficult thing is there is not one absolute that you can say AIDS, drugs, violence, you know, as a child or anything else that causes that, because it's varied. And thankfully, it's not a large number of these cases where you can develop over time and say, boy, this really is the trend. So they're not seeing a whole bunch of things that you can say and point to, but that certainly is a factor in that, and there's a lot of different factors. Again, one of the things that's most prevalent in this whole thing is the access to firearms, right? And if we were able to limit that, and mental health is one of the biggest concerns there. But it's hard to say because not all of them had mental health issues. But anyone who thinks in their mind that it's appropriate to walk into a situation and shoot as many people as they can, I would certainly argue have some mental health issues, but not pre-diagnosed. And so that's one of the difficult things that takes place. Just along that, I'll tie that in a little bit to the gun thing, because there's a big raging debate about magazine capacity. Interestingly enough, in the majority of those cases, I think 60-something percent of the cases, police officers intervene and stop the suspect from doing what he was doing. Right? In those 67% of the cases in which they did that, about 60% of those, the officers were able to intervene in the point where the person had run out of ammunition and was either reloaded, changing guns, or doing something. So if you reduce the number of magazines that they have available, or the capacity in a magazine, the number of bullets they have available, that gives more opportunities for the police to interact, and that is a proven fact. And so it makes sense, some of these things that, boy, we ought to be looking at this. But again, access to firearms is the one thing across the board that all these people have. There's a bunch of different factors that play in. But unfortunately, whatever that factor may be in their mind, you know, drug abuse or anything else, you now give access to firearms and look what happens. And see, I'll make the argument. The thing that kills more police officers in this country than anything else, felonious accidents or anything else, is suicide. And I've had three officers commit suicide in the last 4.5 years. And, I mean, you know, there's lots of things that you can point to, stress and everything else. And I certainly, again, don't want to minimize that or talk light of it. But the common thread is there is a triggering event that takes place, whether that's a family fight, whether it's money problems or whatever it is. There's this big event that occurs. A lot of times it involves alcohol. And then you throw in, because we always have guns available, and we're very good when we use a firearm and kill ourselves. And I am convinced that at least in two of the three cases that I have, had I been able to separate the event and the alcohol from the firearm for just a minute or an hour, that that would not have occurred. But because the firearm is readily accessible at the moment that that happens, combined a lot of times, like I say, with alcohol, then you get that tragic event. And so the same thing, you can think about some of these shootings. Right? If we, because we're not going to stop mental illness in this country. We're not, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to take place. We're not going to stop tragic events or these other things that occur. But if you can now separate for even a moment or make it more difficult for these people who fall into that category to have access to firearms, well, maybe we'll prevent some of these. And certainly, I mean, that was one of the things. Sitting in the Roosevelt room with the president and the vice president and the attorney general, one of the things that weighed most heavy on me is the fact that, boy, there's a tremendous responsibility. People are losing their lives, and I'm being asked by the president of the United States to give my input on what I think may reduce it. I mean, you got to look and say, boy, what's going on and how can I change this? What can we do to change this behavior? And so a lot of responsibility comes to that. And I think it's the responsibility of all of us to stand up and say, boy, we need some more reasonable things in place in order to prevent some of this from occurring. Please.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Roberts, and I'm in Professor Chambliss's class. And I guess I was just curious. We've talked a little bit about the unified police departments and how there's been some, I guess, streamlining of law enforcement. I'm just curious how you feel about this, if we were to streamline, you know, police, fire, SWAT, homicide, if we had more specialization but were an overall state force or, you know, city force instead of being separate for each city and county and et cetera.
There's a lot of different issues tied up in this that so you'll kind of get me going both ways. One of the things that is important to note is I think policing is done best at a local level because crime and disorder is a local thing. And my officers are most effective when they have a relationship or knowledge of the people and area that they are policing. So the problem that you get is the larger your area of jurisdiction, so like the federal government, let's say. So if you said the FBI is now going to handle policing, they are far too distant to deal with most of the local disorder types of things that you want them to deal with. And there is a difference between policing in the Northeast, the South, and the West. And then you get even nuances. There's a significant difference in policing between Salt Lake City and Provo. Right? And what the expectation of the public is. And so the notion that you are better off doing this large force, no, what you lose is the personal interaction that is so important and really is the reason that you drive crime down, is because of that public trust and that development of a relationship that takes place. Absolutely, we should always be looking at how can we better utilize the resources that we have. And the difficulty is, so Salt Lake City is a full-service police department. Right? I have homicide detectives that do homicide detectives, or homicides, right? And that's all they work on, right? I have motorcycle units. I have a SWAT team. I mean, the list goes on and on. I have burglary detectives that all they work are burglaries, right? In fact, I have detectives assigned. So they don't work burglaries throughout the entire city. They work burglaries in a specific area of town so they can start to learn and understand these things. What you unfortunately find with smaller jurisdictions in some cases is you have five detectives and they work everything. And they don't have the resources available to them. But as you look at some of these, well, then, so why don't we just unify everything? Well, my responsibility is Salt Lake City, right? I have the most resources, right? The citizens of Salt Lake City pay for those resources, right? And the service level that they've grown to expect. If I now say, okay, Draper, West Jordan, I mean, whatever it is, we're there, right? Well, now those resources that are dedicated solely to the well-being of Salt Lake City and the good services provided, I mean, we solve almost 100% of our homicides, which is unheard of in anywhere in the country in Salt Lake City. And that has to do because I call out a lot of people. I mean, when I have a homicide, I call out about 25 people to investigate that and participate and work on that. That's bigger than some cities have in police force entirely in the valley. But what happens is I start to dilute the resources and the dedication that takes place here. And that's unfortunately what you've seen with some of these unifications. What's happened is they brought cities in, used it to fill vacancies that exist in their current staffing. So if there was, let's say, 1,000 police officers in the area at the time, right, and you now say, well, I have 50 vacancies here that I'm going to use these officers from this city that I'm now incorporating or unifying, right, to cover this, well, I've just diluted the number of police officers by 50. I've unified and we're working together, but now I've diluted the entire number. So somebody's getting less service. And that is unfortunately what you see take place across. And it's done in, this is nothing new. Right? Look back in history. Every time economics go down, you know, the economy goes down, you see these unification efforts. Every time the economy rises and it's good, you see everybody split off from all this. I mean, this is, it's nothing new. It's nothing unique. What should have been done 40 years ago in this valley is Salt Lake City, as far as services, right? I don't know about all the political boundaries. Should have been one political service district, one police force, one garbage service, one everything else that is the same and equal for everybody. But that's not the way it developed. And so to say that it's best to separate that is difficult because you want that personal interaction. And you also don't want your resources going away to something else. And so we do a lot of things, but every time I send an officer somewhere else in the valley, well, that is taking away from what goes on in Salt Lake City and what is my responsibility. So, I mean, it's always a balancing act. And so I'm not a big proponent of it because it should have been done a long time ago. And what you see is big places, right? You look, Miami-Dade is a good example of this, right? It's a big metro police force, but sitting right in the middle of that is Miami PD. Because it doesn't provide the service level that they need for that particular city. And so the larger cities are not, I mean, I think those unification efforts are better in smaller, more rural areas to share resources between a bunch of smaller agencies as opposed to trying to pull some of the large agencies in. Question.
Hi, my name is Faisal Marshad. I'm a political science student. My question is, as a chief of police, how do you ensure equal treat for all? And how do you handle corruption in the police force?
Okay, very good question, because I had two goals, right, and still have two goals, right? First is to humanize my officers in the eyes of the public. And the second is to ensure that every single person that my officers interact with is treated equally and fairly. And that's a hard, hard thing, because, I mean, it takes constant evaluation. It takes a great deal of, because you don't want to have a police officer, right? My officers don't function best if the police chief has their thumb on top of them all the time. I mean, I need to send them out to do the work. I cannot be there. So what I try and do, and again, you get a little personal opinion, is I set the tone, right? And so I don't show up on a homicide, right? I put people in place that I trust to investigate that. I don't show up on a traffic accident. And even if people are killed, the police chief doesn't show up on that because I put people in place that I trust and know. But occasionally, so the Occupy movement, the DeChristopher protests, different large-scale events, Destiny Norton, a little girl who was killed, I show up because I think it's important for me to go and say, this is how I think my officer should interact, right? One, they're highly critical incidents that are occurring that the police department is taking some criticism or potentially may take criticism. It's my role to show up and take that criticism and to make sure that we're doing, I set the example, right? And so what I try and put in place is, this is what my expectation is. And I'll tell you right now, not every one of my officers agrees with my position on immigration. There's no question about that. But every single one of them is going to interact with people the way I say we're going to interact with. And so it starts from the moment I bring somebody in the door. Every single person is going to be a police officer, sits down in the chair at my table, and gets to hear from me what my expectations are. And I get to hear from them what they have to say about those expectations and how articulate they are. Because the most important thing is not how strong they are. Fred's my executive officer back there. What do Fred and I have in common when you look at the two of us? We're big white guys, right? And 20-something years ago when we hired on, they were looking for big, strong guys. Can you handle yourself in a fight sort of thing? Right? Policing has evolved and changed. Now the most important thing for me is their ability to articulate. The most important thing that I have on my belt, and I don't have a lot, but, you know, officers carry all kinds of stuff, those people who work for a living, is their ability to talk. And so that's what you have to look for, people who are going to do the right thing, and then you have to make sure that they're doing the right thing. When someone calls and complains, that's civilian review boards. That's my personal review. And people know, I mean, I have a reputation. If you lie in the police department, I don't care if it's internal affairs, if it's on a report, if it's to the public, you don't have a job and you don't work for me anymore. Right? You don't get one chance or two, you get no chance, right? You lie, you go away. And I hold officers to a high expectation. And I think that's very important that you follow through with some of that and make sure that you're sending that message. So every single, you know, someone calls, I investigate it. Right? If I hear one, and that's partly why I go out and speak to a lot of people and interact, because I want to hear what's going on from the public. It's very easy for me to hide away in my office, right? But I like to go out and talk to the people. In fact, I make my staff nervous because I love to wander downtown, right? And just talk to people. And that's the best that people come up and say, hey, I have a problem here. Or, you know what, I had an officer who did this. Well, I said, okay, thanks very much. I'll find out what went on. And I look at those and take those very seriously and make sure that, and the officers know, yeah, this is the expectation. And so it's a long process, but I think you put it in place and make sure that you're consistent and follow through, and that's how you deal with those situations. And you don't tolerate misconduct or poor behavior. We give police officers a tremendous amount of responsibility. In fact, I could put the handcuffs on this young lady and Fred could take her to jail and no one's ever going to question. I don't have to have any reason to. Now, eventually, right, someone's going to catch up to me and say, hey, wait a minute, why'd you book her into jail? And there's going to be a judicial review and all that that takes place. But I don't have to call and ask permission. Fred doesn't have to ask permission to put the handcuffs and take someone's freedoms away. Nobody calls up the police chief and says, hey, I'm about to shoot this guy. Are you okay with it? Right? And so tremendous responsibility that takes place. And we need to make sure that we put the people in place that can handle that responsibility and are accountable for their actions. And so that's, I think, how you develop a police force that really has public trust and confidence. Time-wise, huh? Oh.
Yeah. This will now conclude today's radio broadcast. Please join me in thanking Chief Burbank.